Run that back, turbo. Run that back, turbo.
Yeah, I'm quarantine clean, so relax.
Relax.
Got my pillows and my bins made back.
Welcome to the TechGory Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. Today's show is brought to you by Home Chef. Home Chef delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients directly to your door with easy-to-follow recipes that fit your lifestyle. Obviously, in quarantine world, you shouldn't be going to grocery stores. I hopefully would recommend that you don't. I didn't like going to grocery stores before the quarantine. I barely know how to cook. It's not functional. And so I was a big fan of Home Chef prior to this, but now obviously timing couldn't be better. They've been an amazing partner of ours. We use them. You can save $100 using promo code TechNori100 for your first order of Home Chef. Do it, folks. Use it. It's not even about the money at this point. It's like, just stay safe. Like, save money and save masks by not going out at all. That's what I'm getting at. The show, Steph Jansen, really excited to talk about everything that OCV is into. Steph Jansen, Vice President of Technology Investments for Orchard Capital Ventures. If you're unfamiliar, they're a LA-based fund, currently a $260 million VC fund focused on Series B US-based companies in the spaces of enterprise software, life sciences, and prop tech. If you know me, you know that that's like checking all my boxes, because I used to spend a lot of time in real estate. I still advise on a company called Second Avenue, which is a prop tech company here locally. And software is what, like 75% of the CEOs and founders that come on this show. That is all fun and cool, but there's more to the story. That's the part that I like. Two things in particular. So if you listen to the show for a long time, you know that we've had a ton of companies. I'm not a ton, 10 companies probably from Startup Nation in Israel. And they have, I mean, Startup Nation is just like crazy successful. There's companies like Waze and many others that are coming out of it, obviously. But the number of companies that have been coming out of Startup Nation as compared to the population is utterly insane. It is very Silicon Valley-esque. And so that's going to be cool to figure out a little bit more about why that might be, and get the thoughts on investing in those companies, especially how do they come to the U.S.? How do U.S. investors look at them? How do they invest in them? Are there rules? Are there ways that this is difficult, or is it easy to do? And then the part that I'm probably most fascinated with is the involvement in equity crowdfunding. I remember the days in like 2015 and 16 and 14 and 17 and really all the way up until now, where I would talk to VCs about equity crowdfunding. I was an early adopter. I partnered with Republic right off the bat before they even launched. We actually looked at turning TechNori into an equity crowdfunding campaign portal until I learned what, you know, good founders adhere to, which is when you see somebody who's better positioned to do it than you, then you back them. So I did that with Republic. I went to VCs all over town here, all over town, in even New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco. And their response to equity crowdfunding was a big F you. They were not into it. I got shit on all the time, to be honest about it. I still kind of do sometimes. I remember all the VCs saying flat out, like telling founders, it's a terrible idea. It's going to ruin your cap table, which is just not true at all. And you know, the truth of the matter is OCV has been in this for quite a while, and they've, you know, our crowd growth story, I think, is pretty remarkable. They've raised over $100 million at a 360 plus valuation pre-money, and it gives you the ability to invest as a regular Joe. I'm a huge fan of it. I mean, I invested in a company. Well, if you listen to my Saturday show on WGN, you know this. Every Saturday, I take two pitches and invest or don't invest in a couple of them, anywhere from Grit Boxing, which I just invested in, to Rocket Dollars, another one I invested some money in. And these are companies that I'm investing like, I don't know, 2,500, five grand or less. I think it's an interesting product. It's an interesting way to get some skin in the game, even though I am accredited, but like, I'm not an angel per se. I'm sort of a weirdo about that. I like being the champion of retail investors. I don't know. It's a weird thing. But anyway, the other part about it that I love is like Reg D, which is companies that are pre-IPO or doing secondaries. So like Topgolf and Airbnb, and probably not companies that I would put my money in right this minute, given the uncertain times, but the ability to invest in those companies and things like Robinhood and others, I think is super valuable, and it's important. And it's also a great opportunity to not just invest, but to actually, I guess, be a part of the whole machine. And the fact that there's venture capital firms out there that are truly backing this and supporting it and behind it in a big way, I mean, to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars, is awesome. So I cannot wait to talk to a VC who actually gets it and share this whole thing with you. So this is my interview with OCV, Vice President of Technology Investments, Steph Jansen. Okay, so I have to start everything off here by just telling you how many VCs I've talked to who gave me nothing but grief about equity crowdfunding. They thought I was insane. When we started in 2015, I was talking to so many investors, companies, everybody, just about what I thought the potential that equity crowdfunding had. And, you know, I mean, I can't even tell you the list of very, very, very notable VCs who either told me it was nuts and I was making a mistake, or the companies I was talking to who were told by their VC or their investors that it's a terrible decision and it will mess their cap table up and everything. And now fast forward, you know, we have the WGN radio show we do on Saturdays, and companies have raised more than $50 million through that show, equity crowdfunding from retail investors. And it's starting to really turn on. And so I can't wait to talk to you more about that and sort of learn what drew you guys to that. But first, you know, welcome to the show.
Yeah, pleasure to be on it. And you know, apropos the equity crowdfunding piece, look, I've been on both sides of the table now. So I started at OurCrowd, which is today one of the largest equity crowdfunding platforms in the world, focusing on kind of startups. So alongside AngelList there. And I've also been a traditional VC in my current role. So I work for OCV, which is an LA-based, very traditional style venture fund. So I understand why VCs are not huge fans of equity crowdfunding platforms. In a sense, we in my old role have democratized an industry that was very opaque, you know, and that's the way they liked it. Right? Equity crowdfunding has come on and shed a light on exactly what this, you know, mystical diligence process is, and made it available for people who were not playing this game before, and opened up this asset class to individual non-institutional investors. It's been a ride to kind of see that process from the front row seat.
Yeah, I mean, I got to tell you, it's interesting. The part that was interesting to me, I think, was as I talked to investors in the early going of this and telling them like we were going to, you know, lean into this, I understood I understood the fear. I understood that they would lose some power because a company could basically say, hey, I'm not all in on you. I can raise $1 million here and there. I mean, at a certain level. But like once you get into like the real rounds, the bigger round, not that that first million is not real, it is, but like once you start getting into the B and the A and C and all these, like that's not, I mean, Reg D is a thing for equity crowdfunding, but that's not like a competitor. And I always thought that it was bizarre to me that they didn't realize that they could, like, the benefit it would have for the company they're investing in. Like, I'm putting money in you, and then you're going to raise another million from, you know, on very, very favorable terms for you, the founder, from retail investors that could also become customers. You're looking at maybe running up to $1 million, essentially a campaign that could ultimately just be marketing, of which you get the money back. And the terms are just like, depending on where you're at, but like we use Republic a lot and it's a crowd safe. Like it's pretty favorable. And so it always kind of blew my mind that they were so against it from the get go. And I understand they don't like change, but like, I don't know, maybe I'm nuts. I was surprised. Normally I'm not surprised by responses. This one, I really was like blindly surprised that so many investors were like, you're an idiot.
So yeah, it was a very exciting concept. I think we did well. I think now Alka has got some to their belt. Some notable ones include Jump Bikes, which we sold to Uber, Argus Continental, which we sold for $500 billion Argus, which we sold for $500 billion to a German company called Continental. Beyond Meat, we were in that one. We were in Hyperloop before Richard Branson came in and made a Virgin Hyperloop, although that hasn't exited yet. I think we've shown that this is a new way of making investments and a new way of adding value.
I agree with you, obviously, and I've been sort of championing this as like the retail investor champion. And I really do think that like the biggest part of this, from my side of this, is like your ability to reach out to the network. You're talking about millionaires and accredited investors. That's one thing. As we extend this into retail, and there are more companies even looking at retail on top of doing the accredited route of crowdfunding on top of the traditional route of investing, you have an army of advocates. And that's the part that I thought was a no-brainer to me when I jumped into it. And then there's the democratization of this. Like, you know, there's the level you're talking about, which are individual millionaires who can angel invest on their own, but they would never have a chance of getting in on an investment in, you know, Beyond Beef. Like, that's not going to be something that they have a shot at. The retailers have zero chance. So having these people have a shot at investing in things that previously were sort of reserved, like the top 1%, I think is really attractive and cool. And obviously it has a great impact for the companies. So there's that. You leave there and now you're at OCV and you're wearing the other hat. And I have to feel like if you came from that, from the crowdfunding side of this, you have to be fairly founder friendly. So tell me a little bit about the fund you're at now and what you guys are focused on.
Yeah, well, actually, just to seize on the previous point you made, you know, if you're launching a retail consumer-facing product, I mean, yes, equity crowdfunding is great, but you actually have several fantastic options in other forms of crowdfunding over there, right? So if you're retailing a product that's going out to the consumer market, I mean, traditional crowdfunding, you know, non-equity crowdfunding is just a fantastic option for you, right? Because that is non-dilutive. And not only that, but many of the people who are crowdfunding your campaign in that case. And now we're talking about companies like Kickstarter and Indiegogo. Yeah. So if you're crowdfunding by a Kickstarter, number one, you're not getting diluted. Number two, a lot of the people who are making investments, quote unquote, right, are actually buying your product. And so, yeah, you immediately can make some money by pre-selling a lot of your product up in advance and also just kind of testing to see whether they're really market fit over there and before you go and spend the next 5 years of your life on this venture. Totally, so traditional totally crowdfunding is just a fantastic route for you. Coincidentally, you know, we ended up doing a lot of traditional crowdfunding alongside equity crowdfunding. So just by the way, if I've lost anyone in your audience over here, traditional crowdfunding, think Kickstarter, you're donating usually small amounts, you know, $150. Maybe you're getting a perk, you know, a t-shirt. Maybe you're buying, pre-purchasing a bit of the product. But what you're not doing is you're not buying equity, right? Equity crowdfunding, you're making larger investments, usually kind of $1,000 and up. In the case of Outcrowd, we had a $10,000 minimum. And you're actually buying a piece of the company, right? So you actually get a piece of the upside if the company succeeds. And we actually did at Outcrowd hybrid campaigns, right, where we were doing equity crowdfunding alongside traditional crowdfunding. So an example of that was we invested in a company called Consumer Physics. They were miniaturizing a little spectrometer, which you could point at cheese and it would tell you, hey, this is cheese, right? Or you could point at a pill and it would tell you, this pill, you know, take it, or this is the wrong pill. Or you could point it at gold and it would tell you this is real gold or this is fake gold, right? So, you know, the tricorder from Star Trek, it was literally a tricorder. And we raised, if I recall, about $3.5 million for them alongside a campaign which they ran on Indiegogo where they raised $2.5 million. At the time, and these were, you know, the early days of crowdfunding, this was 2013, this was, I think, the seventh most successful consumer electronics campaign on Indiegogo in Indiegogo's history. And interestingly, right, so they had the option to take both non-dilutive money from a crowdfunding platform and dilutive money from us, from Outcrowd. It was interesting that they chose to do both, right, because they, and this really validates the concept that I was talking about before, they, I think, really believed that by having all these investors on board, we would be able to actually add value to them beyond just owning the product and buying the product. And then the other option that you have that's available to you if you're going to launch a consumer-facing product, specifically around CPGs, there are great crowdfunding platforms today. Like I think Google has one called Circle Up, and so, you know, they have this huge data advantage where they're able to, you know, being Google, they can just go out there and identify gaps in the market for CPGs and launch products which they believe address those gaps. Right. So if you're doing something that's really kind of public-facing. Crowdfunding has got all these other advantages to beyond what equity crowdfunding can offer.
Well, I'll tell you, if people on this show don't know about crowdfunding at this point, I think I might cry a little bit because obviously we've got the Saturday show on WGN where we hear pitches from companies who are equity crowdfunding for the retail investor. You know, the I think the total now is like 50 million that we've helped these companies raise. It might be more than that. So we've got like 75,000 people who listen to this show that have done an investment there. So I sure hope that they understand the nuances of crowdfunding at this point. So tell me more about your day job now. What are you guys involved in? What are you guys looking at?
Sure. So I, about 2 years ago, I moved out to LA. I moved out to California. My accent's completely fake. So I'm Israeli, born in Israel, grew up over there, and then moved to New Zealand when I was 12, actually. But I'm not American. And so when I moved here, I had to wait about a year or so to get my green card, and then finally landed up at my current fund over here in LA. And the fund here is called OTV, and we are a $260 million VC fund. We focus mostly on U.S.-based companies kind of around the Series B stage, pretty loosely defined as companies with roughly $5 million in recurring revenue per year. We don't really have a specific mandate in terms of areas that we have to invest in, but we have three areas where we feel like we can add a lot of value beyond being a checkbook, right? So I mentioned before at OutCrowd, we had to figure out how to elbow our way into companies that were competitive. So this is how we do it at OCB now. So for example, those three areas are, number one, anything to do around enterprise software. And this harks back to our partner, Tammy Zucker. He was the founder and CEO of a company called J2 Global, today a $5 billion NASDAQ-listed company. It might have dropped below that now that we're talking in the age of Corona.
Pre-Corona. That's going to be a new thing, right? When you invest in a company, it's like valuation, pre-money, post-money, and pre-Corona.
But he built this behemoth of a company, and he did it in a very unorthodox way. So he actually made something like 160 acquisitions in his tenure as CEO, and they've made, I think, 50 or so since. And so they built this huge family of companies, a lot of them around kind of enterprise software, cloud assets, digital media. And so when we make an investment in a company, we look for companies that can synergize with that portfolio that they have at J2. So we look for a company that we say, hey, listen, you know, can one of these companies that J2 has bought be a customer? Can they be a distributor? Can they be a partner? Or can J2 even be an eventual acquirer, right? I mean, we built that acquisition machine. We know their criteria very well. The chairman of our board still sits as the chairman of J2 Global. So we are looking basically for anything that allows us to leverage the J2 portfolio. And by the way, most of those are software, but not all of them. So for example, right now, we're about to announce an investment in a baby formula company. And it turns out that one of J2's assets is what to expect when you're expecting. And for all the parents who are listening, they'll of course know that it's at the time, you know, the book to read on the topic, but today it's actually mostly a kind of an online portal where parents go for you know, up-to-date information about everything baby-related. And this was an extremely competitive deal. You know, we knew that they had term sheets from one of, you know, the top three VCs in the world, right, who offered them a partner who was super experienced in food. And we, you know, were able to say, listen, that's great, but what to expect when you're expecting, right? We can do that for you. As what to expect as ventures, right? And that's actually how our chairman introduced us. You know, he said, listen, you know, this is, I'm introducing you to the team that's cheekily, right? What to expect as ventures. So we had a conversation with the company, and we had a conversation with what to expect. We figured that we can add some value over there, and that's how we got ourselves into that deal. So area number one, anything to do with J2, usually cloud and software and enterprise software, but occasionally not. Area number two is around anything to do. So area number two that we're focused on where we feel like we can add value is around healthcare. So one of the partners on our team was the founder of Life Alert Systems, which, you know, you're the right age to remember. I fell and I can't get up ads.
Greatest commercial of all time.
Right. So serial medical entrepreneur. And so, you know, we have a lot of in-house knowledge around that. He's hired a team of life science PhDs who are now kind of prospecting biotech companies, they're prospecting pharmaceutical companies, digital health companies, We've looked at some medical device companies, although we're not huge fans of that, but kind of anything around life sciences and healthcare, we feel like we have a lot of in-house expertise and experience to add some value, both in terms of diligence and picking the right deals and then operationally post-investment. So that's area number two, where we feel like we can be more than a checkbook. And area number three is around anything to do with prop tech. And this caps off our partner, the third partner in our fund, has got a huge history in real estate. So he built a $30 billion real estate-focused private equity shop. And the shop has got tens of square thousands of commercial real estate, parking lots, 7 hotels, as far as I'm aware, multiple data centers, a lot of solar fields, right, and empty land. So whenever we find a technology that can dress over one of those assets, and that could be a sensor for a smart building, that could be software for site selection, right, for where you're going to buy your next piece of real estate, anything where we feel like his private equity could be a customer and we can gain this unfair advantage by rolling out the technology into his portfolio, that's another area where we feel like we can be more than a checkbook. And I'll just give you one example of that. I was talking to a company here in LA that was doing alternative construction materials, let's say. And we were very excited about this because we were talking about, hey, listen, if we make an investment in this, on day one, we can negotiate ourselves a sweetheart valuation because, we can say to them, listen, we can do this amazing thing for you that very few other investors in the world can do for you. We can roll you out into this huge portfolio. And on day two, right, post-investment, we can immediately mentally mark up the value of our investment because we know that this company is going to hit all their milestones for the next two funding rounds because we're going to be the customer, right? Yeah. We're going to just take through to it. So, like to play fair, we look for areas where we feel like we can add value that other investors can't. And those are three areas that we feel like we can have a huge advantage just straight out of the gate. Now, having said that, we are, as I mentioned, we actually don't have a mandate and we are first and foremost opportunists, right? So we'll also make investments outside those three areas where we feel like it makes sense, wherever there's value to be found. Also very flexible in how we do that. So we do straight up equity deals. We do convertible notes, as do many investors, but we'll also do venture debt, which very few investors do. We'll also do majority ownership, which very few VCs do. So we're very flexible in terms of the business models and areas that we can invest in, but we do have those kinds of three pillars that we stand on where we say, this is where we feel like we have massive value add.
How does something like Corona change your approach? We've got VCs we've talked to who are taking the approach of we've got money on hand, but we're not going to make as many investments this year, or we're going to support the companies that we have already invested in that look like they have a lot of, the same potential after Corona as they did before it, but right now they need help. Others, and I'm just going to guess this based on this conversation, are looking at opportunities that maybe wouldn't have been there before this, and this is a great time to jump in, whether that's at a discount or because a company needs some cash on hand right now, or because I kind of think that there's a new world that's being born right before our eyes that is more virtual. And there's, I think, gigantic opportunities, whether it's esports. The Zoom is obvious. Everyone talks about that. But there's a million things that come as a result of people adopting more of a remote workforce. What's your plan? What are you guys looking at?
Yeah, well, so one VC buzzword that's having a moment right now, future of work, right?
Yes. That and dry powder. Thrust. If I hear the word powder one more time, my head's going to explode from dry powder.
Yeah, I have a whole spiel about dry powder, so we'll get into that. But we were all kind of now put into a forced state of work from home. I think absolutely. Whenever the environment changes this violently, there's huge opportunities. So Sam Harris, for example, just released a podcast with Matt Mullenweg, the founding developer of WordPress, and now Automatic, which is a fully distributed organization, 1,000+ employees in 75 countries. They discuss some best management practices as a fully distributed organization that they've been developing for years now, right? And I think the rest of the world is now going to start adapting those practices. That's on the social level, right? Scott Galloway from Section 4, right, this New York University professor, just made the point that shakeups tend to happen during crises because managers have got cloud cover, right, to go in and make massive changes, right, and adopt new technologies. So, you know, I used to work at ING Bank during the global financial crisis. And I was working in the Netherlands, which is a country where labor laws are set up in such a way that it's almost impossible to fire people. But during the global financial crisis, you know, that was the perfect cloud cover to go and fire thousands of people and actually restructure the organization in ways that make sense and replace people with technology. So absolutely, there's huge opportunities happening. And you know, you mentioned Zoom. Zoom is now worth more than all airlines combined. I mean, that's the world that we live in right now. In terms of VCs, right? Look, this is very much a double-edged sword. So portfolio companies are going to need to adjust. We're looking for how we can best support them, right? So we've been, for example, talking about how we deal with, you know, the CARES Act, right? This big stimulus package that just came out that allows certain small and medium businesses to qualify for loans. So we have access to, you know, lawyers and regulatory people who many, you know, small startups don't, so we can do that for them and start earning those management fees if that's one way that we might be able to add value. On the other hand, valuations are plummeting, right? And that's good for VCs because we're seeing good deals now, right? So VC, you mentioned dry powder. That have dry powder, right, are going to be in a great position now because when you look at vintages that are post-financial crisis, like for in 2008, you know, I think Airbnb was founded in 2008. I think Dropbox was founded in 2007, like as the crisis was brewing. And the investments that these companies received around those times, you know, they got crazy returns on those companies because the market was depressing their valuations. In, you know, Silicon Valley Bank just had a webinar last week where they were looking at the crisis. And they mentioned that in the global financial crisis, investments dropped twice as much as valuations, right? And the reason that happens is because around this time, LPs start to bail out of VC funds. So if you, you know, have quote unquote dry powder, as you mentioned, there's dry powder and there's dry powder. There's the LPs now who are calling VC funds and they're saying, listen, I know we have a contract, but don't make a capital call because I would hate to be in a position where I have to say no to you, right? And meanwhile, there are other VCs, right, who have been a lot more selective with who their LPs are, right? And all the top VCs in the world do this. They don't just let anyone do the fund. They're very aware of how recession-proof their LPs are. So if you actually have got real dry powder now and you've got access to cash, you're in a great position because you can make investments at fantastic valuations. By the way, this is also true of private equity funds and corporate development teams, right? If they're sitting on real dry powder because they're funded off balance sheets, they're going to be making fantastic acquisitions in this space. And then throw into this whole mix the fact that in Saudi Arabia are fighting over oil, which is, you know, further weakening the market over here. So there's going to be some amazing opportunities for startups to address the changing needs of the market, for sure.
This sounds crazy, but I'm excited to there. I don't know. This is one of those weird things. Like, I feel bad saying in a time where people are in panic and lives are at stake that I'm looking forward to a little bit of a thinning of the business herd where there's some of the people who have been living on leverage and they're going to basically probably not exist. Some of them are at least lick their wounds and have to come back maybe a little bit smarter. I think there's a lot of opportunities, like in anything in life, if you have liquidity when things go crazy. I mean, I was in the commercial real estate space in 2008 when that happened and working for a group that had a lot of cash and we bought up everything. And that was, you know, just an opportune time. And now, you know, I work with, you were talking about PropTech. My business partner is Mike Rothman. He's the founder, now chairman of SMS Assist, one of the largest property management groups, in the country. So I get to see this firsthand is like some of these groups, like it's tough and the money thing is tough for some, but for others, this is a huge time, and a huge opportunity. And your fund, I think, based on not just the cash, but also based on like the style of which you guys invest, I think has a little bit of extra insulation because you're using businesses that you already have a stake in to propel other businesses that you will gain a stake in. And there's sort of a flywheel effect there, which to slow that momentum requires almost everything, every engine to shut down. And that's, you know, not the case. So very cool there. I think the other thing that I'd love to talk to you a little bit about is obviously you've mentioned before that you were originally from Israel and that you have somehow made your way from Israel to New Zealand to here to LA. Startup Nation is something that we've kept an eye on for a long time. Obviously, people know of Waze, but there's a ton of companies coming out of there. We've probably had, a dozen or so on this show. And I would just love to know, like, how that shaped your view of startups and how that shaped your view of entrepreneurship and investing, because I just, my feeling on it, almost all the companies and founders I've met through Startup Nation have been, I think, very unique as compared to even founders here. There's a certain aggressive nature and very tech forward thinking that they have, that, and that sounds like stupid, right? Because it's technology startups, but like there are those that are very, very tech forward and those that are sort of reliant and enabled by tech. Big difference. How has this all shaped you to get to this spot?
Yeah, well, Israel is a very unique place, right? So just to kind of set the scene for anyone who's unfamiliar, Israel, you know, academically very excels. Israel's got more Nobel prizes per capita than the United States, France, Germany, and Nobel laureates in real numbers in places like India, you know, Spain and China. In terms of VC money, Israel has got about twice the VC dollars per capita invested than the U.S. And our crowd, by the way, I should have mentioned this earlier, at some point became Israel's most active venture capital investor by number of deals rather than by number of dollars invested, although no small fry by number of dollars either. But by the time I left, we had deployed something like $1.5 billion. The U.S. Has got, I think, $130 billion deployed last year. But in Israel, it was something like 6.4 billion, but the U.S.'s population is almost 40 times higher than Israel, right? So on a per capita basis, the dollars deployed in Israel are just through the roof. R&D per capita in Israel, and this is non-military R&D, right? So VC-funded plus non-VC-funded private R&D happening inside companies is the highest in the world. And then the highest number of patents per capita in the world in Israel as well. But when you look at NYSE and NASDAQ listings, right? So unsurprisingly, that the U.S. tops the chart, and China, followed by Canada, and then Israel. And by the way, these are on a non-per capita basis, right? So Israel has got the fourth highest number. I don't know if this is still true. This is definitely true, I think, a few years ago. But at the time, last time I checked, Israel had the fourth highest number of listings on the NYSE and NASDAQ in the world in absolute terms. And this is from a country with the population of New Jersey,
yeah,
right? And then of course Israel is a global leader in multiple fields, right? So, in electronics, the USB flash drive was an Israeli invention by a company called, M Systems, which sold for $1.5 billion to SanDisk. Messaging apps, everyone knows Viber, which sold to Rakuten for $900 million. Or if you're really old school, you know, ICQ, which sold to AOL for almost $300 million. In agriculture, Israel, has brought some high-tech plant genomics and biotech companies like Evogen, but also low-tech solutions like drip irrigation, which was created by an Israeli company called Nefesim, and even just old-school breeding, right, of like cherry tomatoes, an Israeli invention. Drones, Israel is a huge leader. Space, right, Israel basically created the CubeSat industry. In cybersecurity, and an Israeli company sold for $5 billion to Cisco. I mentioned Argus, which we sold out of our portfolio. In mobility, there's a $15 billion acquisition of Mobileye by Intel, and the $1 billion acquisition of Waze by Google that you mentioned. And in micromobility as well, right? I mentioned our sale of Jump to Uber. In gaming, Playtika was a $4 billion sale. In cannabis technology, THC was actually isolated at Hebrew University. And then in medical technology, right? Israel is one of the global leaders in the world. And I'm thinking of companies like Valtech, which is a device to repair heart valves, which was acquired for $1 billion. So, you know, if you're looking at this from the outside, you're looking at this tiny country in the middle of the Middle East, right? Surrounded by deserts with up to very recently no natural resources at all. The obvious question is what's going on over there, right? Like, why is this tiny country punching so much above its weight? And the answer to that is compounded. We can dig into that if you want.
I mean, you might, yeah. Why not? I mean, I think that it's an interesting topic. I mean, when we talk to, I've done some stuff here with the Israeli consulate in Chicago, and they're the ones that sort of give us all these companies. And in the end of it, most of the founders that I've had on and investors actually lead by saying that they, the people, are their best natural resource.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, today the answer is of why Israel punches so high above its weight, it's easy to, in terms of what you just mentioned, in terms of talent, right? So all those companies that I just mentioned, right? It's serial entrepreneurs who go back into the ecosystem and found again, right? Talented engineers, so it's a big pool to hire from, kind of an Israeli version of the PayPal mafia. You also today can look at the presence of large tech companies, right? Both homegrown and imported. So if you drive from Tel Aviv to Haifa, the beach, you pass multiple kind of tech parks. You see names like Google and Intel and Yahoo, and they all have huge R&D centers over there. And those large tech companies play a huge part in the ecosystem, right? So often the way small companies start is you're working for a large tech company. You notice a problem in your day-to-day life. You go to your boss and you say, hey, listen, I think this is what we should do about the problem. Your boss says, no way. You have certain KPIs I need you to meet. You have targets that I need you to meet. And so you, as a young, bright engineer, you know, get frustrated by this. And you say, you know what? I've got the talent to actually build a solution. I really want to do this. So you leave. And so the large companies are necessary for training entrepreneurs in the first place. Then their bureaucracy frustrates entrepreneurs into leaving the large companies. And then you need the large companies at the end of the road to actually acquire the startups that those entrepreneurs found. So in a very counterintuitive way, the presence of large tech companies is a hugely important factor for the success of small startups. So in a sense, you know, Israel's current success can be explained by looking at what's happening over there today. But rewinding back to the 60s and 70s, right? Again, you're looking at a country that's a brand new country that was founded in 1948, right? So no long history to draw on. As I mentioned, again, no natural resources at the time. You know, the joke in Israel is that Moses led his people to the only place in the Middle East with no oil, right? Now they've found some natural gas, but this is new, right? And no allies, right? I mean, in the 60s and 70s, Israel was fighting existential wars. So that's a little bit harder to explain of how the startup nation kind of arose in that petri dish, right? And so when you're looking at the answer to that, that's a little bit harder to explain. So, you know, another aspect is how the military pertains to talent, right? So in the military, you're trained to work in teams to accomplish mission-critical objectives while adapting to unknowns, right? So let's just break that down for a sec. So you're trained to work in teams, so trained. What other 19-year-old in the world can hack into a Syrian government computer and steal data, right? That's actually a training program in the Israeli army. That's something you can learn to do over there. So trained, we covered that, to work in teams, so working in teams. That's actually extremely important, right? Founder infighting kills a huge percent of startups. But if you happen to found a startup together with someone who you've already done 4 years of service with, you kind of, they're a known quantity to you, right? You kind of know everything about them that bugs you. It's a risk that you're taking. It's not someone who you met, who you met in your MBA program when you were both in some like unnatural high from not working your investment banking job. And now you suddenly discover all their annoying habits when they become a manager, right? So teams is a very important element of this. And then adapting to unknowns, right? So that transfers very well to startups where everything is just chaos all the time. And then, you know, that's kind of the elements of, well, once you've come under fire, right, in the army, the idea of failing in business seems kind of trivial by comparison.
Yeah.
And that's true both of combatants and civilians, right? So I, as I mentioned, I moved from Israel to New Zealand when I was 12. So I wasn't in Israel from military age, which is 18 to 21. Everyone in Israel serves in the army during those ages. All men do, women serve 18 to 20. And but civilians like me, right? I came back at 26 as an adult in 2014. You know, Israel came under rocket fire, and in a little bit later there was what was called. I was living in Jerusalem. There was something called the stabbing intifada going on over there, right? So there was a series of about 200 stabbings and car rams that was happening around. And you know, whenever I start talking about this, I kind of get a little bit of a ping of guilt, and I just want to make sure to plug Israel over here and say that, you know, terrorism as a risk in Israel is completely negligible compared to the risk of getting in your car on the road in LA, right? So let's keep these things in perspective. Okay, plug over. But I will say that, you know, having lived in a country where the stress of terrorism or the stress of war is somewhere in the background, that does give you a little bit of a different perspective on on the risk of founding a company.
Oh, right? For sure. I mean, it has to.
Yeah. And then necessity, right, plays a big role over here. So, for example, satellites. Typically, satellites launch from west to east. And that's because the Earth rotates that way at about 1,000 miles per hour. And if you launch satellites in that direction, you give them that boost, right? You give them the boost of the rotation of the Earth. The problem is that in Israel, if you launch in the direction, if you launch eastwards, right, your satellite flies over Iraq, Iran, Syria, right? And you know, when Israel was first launching its satellites and became one of the first space-faring nations in the world, there was a concern that satellites would be shot down if they were actually launched over those countries. So Israel's solution to that was, okay, let's miniaturize the satellite to the point where we can actually launch it in the direction of west, right, where it's small enough that we don't need to give it that boost from the rotation of the Earth. And Israel created the whole microsat and CubeSat industry from that innovation, right? And you know, now you can launch a satellite in Israel for about $100,000, which is less than the cost to build an app, right? And so at our crowd, we started investing in a bunch of satellites that came out of that ecosystem. We invested in a company called NSLcom. And so that was, you know, one of these things that came out of necessity. Or another example of that is a company called Given Imaging, right? So this was a company that was miniaturizing cameras, right, for military use. I think some of them were supposed to go on missiles, right? And so again, if it's going to fly, it needs to be as light as possible. And the team that did that basically kept on miniaturizing these cameras until they said, well, actually, we can get this so small that we can put it in a pill, and then you're going to swallow it. And then that is going to image your intestines, and it's going to replace the need for colonoscopy, right? And so they sold that solution to Covidien for $960 million. And then there's non-military necessity too, right? So, you know, Israel is in a desert, right? With water security is an issue over there. So they made huge investments in water desalination over there, one of the largest in the world, and in water recycling. So Israel, for example, recycled something like 85% of its water. It's the highest in the world. The next highest country in the world is Spain. They recycle, I think, something like 11% of their water. So, you know, when you just need to innovate to get things done, right, that definitely adds a bit of a boost. So military is a big part of it. We've talked a bit about academics. We've talked about institutions. And then culture, right? So Israel is notoriously informal as a culture. There's a Dutch researcher called Kurt Hofstetter who went around the world looking at every country and seeing how they compare it on all these parameters. So, for example, collectivism versus individualism, right? Where do you fall on that parameter? One of the parameters they measured was how respectful you are towards hierarchies, right? And Israel, when they came to finally survey Israel, just completely was off the charts. They you know, they broke the scale. So that definitely helps in a startup kind of environment, right? Where you have very flat hierarchies, where everyone is expected to take initiative, right? Be a leader and not just be told what to do. Immigrants play a huge role as well, right? So Israel in the 90s absorbed something like a million Russians. Right. Now, remember, this is a country that at the time had 7 million people, or I think 6 million people at the time, maybe even. I can't remember. But that would be roughly the equivalent of the U.S. absorbing the population of France. Right. So, I mean, we're talking about like the political narrative over here is, yeah, the political narrative.
20% of the population.
Right. I mean, you can imagine, right, people talking about we're worried about a convoy coming from Latin America right now. Imagine if some politician came along and was like, listen, guys, we're absorbing France, like what's happening.
So, hey, you know what? Who knows? I don't want to even go there because you never know.
Yeah.
This current environment is a little crazy.
Yeah.
No, right. I think you're right. I think it's the convergence of, it's like a, you know, the perfect storm of, you know, the makeup, the history, the type of people, the way that they have to exist, what they have to go through in order to be able to be successful. The military piece, all of these things play a role in it. I think it's very interesting. I don't know. It's like Silicon Valley in its existence in California as a result of like the Apples of the world and Hewlett Packard. It's sort of a very analogous sort of scenario there, obviously minus the war. This is awesome. This is very, very fascinating. I'm happy to have gotten to know you a little bit and learn about sort of your involvement in crowdfunding and obviously the fund you guys are working at now. Where do people go to learn more and follow you? Because I feel like you should be writing a column if you're not.
Not yet. So you can follow me on Twitter. So I'm @StephJansen. I haven't posted over there in about 2 years. I should probably start.
Yeah, you guys, you have a lot of knowledge that clearly off the shoulder, just roll with it.
Yeah. I recently just started a Medium blog as well. And I don't talk so much about VC over there. I just kind of meander on about personal philosophies and all kinds of things like that. But you can find me on Medium as well. And I think, and then always on LinkedIn, you know, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. If you're a founder and you have a cool idea, I'd love to hear from you.
Very cool. Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate you taking the time on the show. Obviously, everyone listening, speaking of equity crowdfunding, this Saturday, every Saturday from noon to one, WGN Radio M 720, I take a couple pitches from companies and invest in them. You can do the same, register at Republic to do that. And obviously following Technory everywhere, including Spotify, follow me at Katoon. Boom. That's a wrap.